little bit about the Chevrolet studio at that time as you came in. Tell us a bit about Ed Glowacki and the hierarchy there, how it was when you first
met. Well, Ed Glowacki was a fine person and very well respected throughout our organization as a person with good taste and design ability, and he was a perfectionist.
49 Chevrolet, a little success.
All Chevrolets were successes.
Right.
And, you know, in those days, and for some years to come, Chevrolet was felt to be, within the organization, to be sort of a small family.
Mm-hmm.
There was that feeling behind it when you worked on it, and it should have the same kind of quality. Ed was also a sports car lover, and he would make trips to Europe, and quite often would come back with the title for sports car. He had a Ciata, S-I-A-T-A, which is I don't think they made very many of them, pretty much a special custom car, small.
Yeah. Not at all. Yeah.
No, it was made in Italy.
Italy, okay.
And I don't remember what parts they used, or maybe they were all Ciata parts. It was one of those cars. It was not 100% reliable, but it was fun to drive and fun to look at. It's very attractive to look at. He had one of those for several years. Among the other people that we had at the time, there was Carl Renner, who stayed with Chevrolet for quite a while, and we'll get into that a little bit later.
That's fun.
Carl Renner, R-E-N-N-E-R. I think he now lives in California. There was also Bill Steer, who was a designer, and then he later went to Chrysler. S-T-E-R-E. And he stayed there for a number of years, or maybe he's still there. Started working on the 1953 Chevrolet in the early 50s.
Was this to be a big new car?
New car, total car. It was somewhat similar to the 49, 50, 51, except it was a little bit bigger and more heavier appearing car. Found amusing was that we had to deal with some of the Chevrolet engineers, and they had some hard and fast rules about design. And one of them was that you have to be able to put a milk can, a farmer's milk can, upright in the trunk. Now, how's that for something to work around?
And close it. And be able to close it?
No, not necessarily, but it had to be in there with the trunk lid down, and there was clearance to put it in. We had engineers that would come over and just, if you didn't have that, that was the first thing they looked at. If you didn't have that, you didn't have a car.
Where did this cliche come from? Why was it still being promulgated?
Well, there were a lot of farmers that had Chevrolets, and that's how they hauled their milk cans in those days. Now, today it wouldn't mean a thing, because you don't do things that way. And maybe that day, at that time, the time had already passed, I don't know. But anyway, they still had that.
These are engineers.
These are engineers.
And they're still dictating at this point.
Well, not dictating, but let's say they're influential. And, you know, if you wanted to get something past them, sometimes you had to do what they said. Of course, we also had people with influence in our place. And if it was necessary, you maneuvered them into position.
Uh-huh.
Now, I'm sure Harley Earl would never have listened to that. Sometimes it did.
Who was president of the Chevrolet division by then?
General manager.
General manager of Chevrolet. In the early 50s.
Well, I'll think of that in a minute, I suppose. Somewhere in the late 1953 or 54, Ed Cole came in as chief engineer from Cadillac.
What occasioned this transfer?
Well,
or was that the standard?
Someone up above said it's time to make a change. Mm-hmm. And at that time, Ed Kelly was moved on to another job, and Ed Cole came in.
Sort of a regular rotation.
I loved Ed Kelly. I thought he was a fine person.
Mm-hmm.
But he was entirely different than Ed Cole.
What way?
Well, Ed Cole was just so full of life and ambition and ideas. There was no comparison. Ed Kelly was very nice to deal with, and he stayed over in engineering and let us run our business and accepted what we told him. But Ed Cole came over and worked with us.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the difference. He was a great leader in that he would work with you. And he was so full of ideas. And if we knew instantly if he was not satisfied with what we were showing. We would show him. I think before I get into this, I might say that in 1953, I think it was, I was made chief designer of Chevrolet, and Ed Blackie moved on to another job.
Contributed to your qualities, quiet authority, accomplishments, assignments of increasing the stature,
something
combination of all of them.
So it was such a pleasure to work with him.
That's fine.
And he would come over probably daily or every 2 days, and this was unheard of before, that anybody in his position would spend that much time. But he felt design was so important to Chevrolet. And of course, his mind was not on the 54 Chevrolet. That was history.
Right.
But the 53, which was still in existence when he first came. What he was looking for was that all new Chevrolet that he was going to be involved in.
That was 55.
And 55 took a lot of effort, a lot of work. This time, I think Chevrolet was feeling the push from Ford. So they knew they had to come out with something. Ford had a V8, and Chevrolet still had their 6.
Uh-huh.
And that was starting to tell in the marketplace.
Uh-huh. Why had they been so conservative about the 6?
It was making money.
Oh, okay.
That's my reason. I think probably that was their reason. And I think that also is why Kelly was down to another job. They wanted some more dynamic guy in there,
right,
who would push this V8.
Uh-huh.
And of course, Cole had all this experience in the V8s at Cadillac.
Right.
And he was going to come over and do a Chevrolet Cadillac. And he brought with him Harry Barr, who was his assistant chief engineer.
How do you spell V8?
B-A-R-R. And Harry had been deep into the V8s since his business. They were both experts on engines.
So in a sense, they were going to revitalize the division.
That's right.
Before you get into that, is there anything you would say at this point about the hierarchical importance of the engineer, body engineers versus the body designers? How did that work? Were the engineers still pretty much the had the last say?
Harley Earl was still there.
Right.
He pretty much ran that store when it got up to his level. He treated engineers with disdain. And he would talk about the engineers with wore their hats all the time, and they had pencils in their coat pocket or shirt pocket.
Well, it doesn't have pens and pencil.
And never take their overcoats off.
Never roll up his sleeve.
So he would make fun of them at certain times. At other times, he would butter them up.
Stodgy, unimaginative.
Yeah. And, you know, his history was showed how typical that was. There were a lot of stodgy engineers. And they didn't understand this whole new highfalutin thing called dialing.
Times were changing fast.
And it frightened them, and Harley Earl made use of that. He frightened them as much as he could. And sometimes he wouldn't even talk to them.
Obviously, someone recognized Cole as a superior person with a lot more imagination, a lot more ideas than the normal body engineers. Who was astute enough?
Well, of course, he wasn't a body engineer. He was basically an engine man in experience, but he was also astute enough to understand all.
Right.
And he had a good feeling, I thought, about what the public wants.
And
he was the kind of person who would talk to anybody that he would meet about cars, which was his big interest.
Car images. So I suspect that Earl, that Cole was one of the people that one of the engineers that Earl felt measured up to his
very much head. So. Yeah.
Yeah. So they got a lot of things.
Up to a point. Up to a point. There came a time when they didn't agree on some things. In fact, there was some competition. Is it all right if I mix this up a little bit?
Please do.
From year to year?
Oh, yeah. Don't worry about that.
Okay. There were times when Cole would want to do something that Earl violently objected to. But they didn't meet head on in a battle, usually. But they would find another way to maneuver. I remember one time on the 1958 Chevrolet. Remember that one with the funny birds making
in
the back?
And very much,
very much undercut?
Yes.
Well, we were started down that road, and Earl would come in on a Saturday morning, for example.
You were describing among the fins, that curved outrigger type thing.
Yes.
On the rear
of the 59 Chevrolet.
Yeah, right.
And Earl would came in one Saturday morning, and he said, has Cole been around? This is after they were having a few battles. And each one wanted to outdo the other one. And he said, well, how does Cole like this undercut on the fin? Seems to like it all right. I wonder if we're going far enough. Cut it under some more. In the afternoon, Earl had gone home, had gone somewhere, and Cole came in. He said, well, has Harley been in lately? And I said, yeah, he was in this morning. How does he like this undercut? Well, I said he had his undercut a little bit more. Well, I don't think that's enough. Take it in some more. And he grabbed a tool, a clay modeling tool, out of the modeler's hand, and he said, I'll show you. And he raked through it, and clay spilled off. He went in another 3 or 4 inches. Well, it was getting really ridiculous, almost.
They almost met.
They almost met.
Yeah.
So after each one left, we would fill it in a little bit more, because it was getting kind of bad.
A little bit subtly.
But you see, they were in competition with each other. They didn't want to be outdone.
You're moving toward the 56, you said?
Yeah.
55 was the key Chevrolet engine.
Yeah, that took a lot of time. There was a lot of attention put on that car. And of course, we knew what the mechanicals were going to be. This great new V8 engine was the keystone. And what, for that time, was very good suspension and all the newest things. It was a totally new car. There wasn't one nut or one bolt carried over from the earlier 54 Chevrolet. This was a completely all new car. And it had to look all new.
What would be the procedure, though, Dave? Would you receive from the body engineering department a package drawing?
Well, we were given the wheelbase and the tread.
Key dimensions.
Not very much more than that. And, of course, as with any new design, it starts on the sketch board with individual sketches. The designers would ranges of new cars, and there would be a lot of variation, a lot of different treatments. And then from those, there would be some choices made, and then changes, maybe thrown away, and then other choices made. And this went on for several months until you started to close down to a design.
And all you had was a wheelbase car.
Yeah, well, we didn't worry about that at first.
Yeah.
Because we knew about what size it would be.
These were very early sketches, proposal sketches.
Right. And then, of course, Harley Earl would come in and pick and choose a few things or throw them all out, which happened many times. And then we would also have full-size drawings made from various sketches to choose from. One of the things that we wanted in this all-new Chevrolet was a simplicity of design and a smoothness of design. And I remember on the front end, on the 55, we had all kinds of shapes for the grille and sizes. And Harley had been to Europe shortly before that, so he had the idea that we wanted a small, what do you call it, Ferrari front end. What finally came out on the car, Ferrari type front end with a crate within a small grille. But as in contrast to that, we also had been working on a wider front end, because you know the story back then was wider and longer and lower. So everything had to have things exaggerated. And he didn't want that for the Chevrolet. On the other hand, Chevrolet did, Chevrolet Division. So there was a battle. We designed cars both ways, because we really had to work for both men.
And the men probably had a couple of
men. Yeah, by this time.
Yes. So the battle of the Titan really.
And this went on until we had two prototypes shown at the proving ground at the annual meeting of the board of directors. We had a narrow front end, Ferrari front end, girl and the wife, and the word came back that we were to go to the narrow
Ferrari.
So there was, you know, there was some campaigning done at the board, at the board of directors show, and somebody put in the word probably Earl had talked to his friends.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought that 55 Chevrolet was just it was a beautiful car, and the public thought so too.
What were the outstanding characteristics of the design?
Well, at that time there was a tendency to overchrome the car, and we had tried not to do that. It was
very simple.
Kept it simple.
How about the fins? They were just beginning.
Well, they hadn't really started at that time. They started in a little bit in 56, and then 57 was bigger, and 58 was bigger. 59 is where they really...
Where they finally stopped.
Mm-hmm.
This is interesting to speculate. What, as designers, keeping up with the trends, keeping up with competitors, what did you begin to notice?
Cadillac was the first one.
They were emulating the examples.
Aircraft.
Oh, well, that's right. Of course, the old, the famous B-38 light.
Yes. Yes, we would, styling sent a group of designers out to Selfridge Field to look at some of the examples of military aircraft.
Yeah.
And most any sketch would have an aircraft in it, because we were emulating that.
The word I got was that Harley was allowed a quick peek at a late model of the B-38.
That might have been, I don't know. I'm not aware of that.
We fell in love.
But in Cadillac, when Bill Mitchell was running Cadillac,
uh-huh.
Is when, and Ed Cole was still cattle shed, which when the fins started to come into being. And there was a lot of people who didn't care for fins at that time, but between Cole and Bill Mitchell, but fin kept getting bigger and bigger all the time.
What were the few design features of the 55 Chevrolet that you remember?
Sure of it.
Nobody had any quite like it.
Well, you know, it became a success. I don't remember the numbers, but they were good.
About this time, you're planning a special new sports car.
Well, this sports car, Corvette, was started in the late 51.
Do you remember? Were you involved in the early planning of it?
Just marginally on the first car, because they had a special studio set aside to do just this car. We were working on the 55 stuff, and our hands were really full.
I can imagine.
And
so who was this farmed out to? It was a special studio.
Well, Harley Earl. It was his thought, his idea. Harley Earl.
Had he been influenced by the European
tradition? Yes, he made at least annual trips to Europe, which lasted a couple, 3 months if he chose to. And he saw everything that was there and was very impressed by Jaguar and MG and some of those cars. And so he wanted an American sports car. And the design of the Corvette was pretty well completed. We had a plaster model when he first showed it to Ed Cole.
This was the final approval.
But it was the first time they'd seen it.
Yeah.
They didn't know anything about it.
Mm. Was it done clandestinely? Only a few people knew about this special project?
Well, I think most of us in design and styling knew about it, but I don't believe Cole knew anything about it. Or he acted very surprised, but he may have known something about it. Known it was coming up.
It was more or less deliberate, man. Earl's part, seal this part.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, of course. If you don't want anybody to complain or to object to it, don't show them.
Don't tell them about it.
And that was a key thing.
Who was the key design one?
Harley Earl.
He was his design.
Yeah, well, he worked with the trying to think of his name. But,
what role did this man called Zoltan Darkov
Chevrolet, who Ed Cole acquired to do the Corvette. This is after the Corvette project had been bought by Cole. And he was brought in afterward to do the engineering. And he had an experience in Europe of doing some racing, and he had been involved in sports cars and also some in this country. I don't know where Ed got a hold of him or where he was at the time, but he became an engineer.
But he's basically an engineer. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I remember the day that Earl showed this model of the Corvette to Cole.
What were the circumstances around that?
Well, he showed it to him as a project that ought to be put in the New York Motorama.
I see. He's coming up that fall. What year is this?
It'd be in the spring of 53.
Okay.
And it was shown to him as a plaster model.
What size?
The engine, you know, where the engine was not determined, where the wheelbase was determined.
Was it full size or was it
full size?
Yeah, okay.
And beautifully finished, painted. And it was shown to them in our auditorium. Surprise. And here's this car that is not a Chevrolet. It's a wonderful new sports car.
No name yet.
No name yet.
Just a code.
That's right. There was no name.
You remember the code?
The name Corvette was chosen later.
What was the code?
I don't remember.
What was the reaction?
Well, Cole was just all over it. He couldn't wait until it was done. I mean, here is something that will put the name Chevrolet right out in front. What do we have for an engine? Well, all they had at the time was a six-cylinder engine that had been around years and years, but Cole said, we'll put three carburetors on it, and it'll up the power to such and such, and that's what was put in it.
Standard six-cylinder.
Well, standard.
With these modifications. Mm-hmm.
And they had to decide the engine would be pulled back to a certain point, 7 inches, 8 inches rearward, to give it the right kind of balance.
Not quite the midships, but between front and midships.
Yeah. I think it was 7 inches pulled back from the normal position, which would give it better balance.
What did that do to the passenger compartment?
Well, the passenger compartment was back, so that could be done. I think they just moved it back as far as they could until it would hit the cow.
And let go of the front space.
Well, there was some front space. That was not important.
Right, yeah. This would be the first true American sports car.
Of course, what Cole was wishing for was to have that new 55 V8. But he couldn't get it. It was too early. This was 1953. The car was finished.
That was still in development.
Yeah, V8. Right. So they had to go through 53. Really, there weren't many cars built in 53. They had to go into 54 and then 55 V8.
Was he responsible for much of the engineering?
Well, after they got the Corvette organized, he was put in charge of the engineering.
Oh, I see. He wasn't in on the very beginning of development.
No, but he came in right about that time.
Uh-huh. After the crew.
Yeah, well, there were stages. First of all, the car was approved to go in the motor amateur.
Okay.
Harley Earl would have put it in there anyway, so that was really taken for granted.
Was it non-drivable?
Well, first, the Motorama car was drivable.
It was.
And they didn't wait for that. They started making what we call mule cars in Chevrolet, immediately to test the drivability and the feasibility of the car. You're going to sleep.
No. It's just my post-lunch finish. It's not. I'm fascinated. So, what were some of the behind-the-scenes battles and decisions about this? Were there anybody who said, we're going too far, or we shouldn't?
Well, they did it in stages. In 1953, they made a decision, yes, we will make 200 Corvettes, and we will make them make the body here at the tech center. And they set aside a portion of the tech center to make these almost hand layup.
This is very early in the tech center's history.
Yes.
Just opened.
Yes. To make these hand layup bodies.
Full size.
Sure. And so there were 200 of those built. I had number 110, I think.
Did you really? The Chevrolet even got first dibs.
Well, I begged Cole a lot.
Oh, did you?
Forget it. I'll never forget the day I went down to pick mine up at a Chevrolet dealer on Jefferson Avenue. You know, here's a car. Down to pick the car up. Here was a car that was not a Chevrolet. It was something else from some other world, as far as they were concerned. One day I took it in for service, some minor thing, and they almost threw up their hands. They didn't know what to do with it exactly. But I never had any real problems with it. It was a fine car. And it was really a sensation when I drove it home. I think every kid in 10 miles away, came around to look at it, to ride in it. And this happened all over the country. It was a great thing for Chevrolet. And Ed Cole was right, and Harley Earl was right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pushed it.
Yeah, pushed it very much.
Had it been you said it was in a special studio. It was not too many people knew about it in the early stages of development.
Well, nobody outside of styling knew about it.
Yeah, okay.
And if there were locked doors, as there were in every studio, so that very few people could get in to see it. But of course, there are rumors and talk. So news did get around.
And everybody wanted to get in and take a look at it. Everybody,
of course.
Find somebody with a key to the studio.
But it was a case of when the car was shown at the Motorama, it was so popular. People liked it so much that instantly Chevrolet got the word to do something about it. Build it. And they had already been working on it. They were smart enough to do that. And then we took over, in the Chevrolet studio, we took over the Corvette.
Did you?
Immediately. There were no changes for 1954. 55, we started to make a few alterations on it. And of course, it then got the new 55 chassis. Under then came a real sports car for the first time. I don't think you could call it 53, 54 with the whole six-cylinder engine for a sports car.
You had to make do with an existing chassis and an existing engine.
Right.
The body was really what was new.
Yes.
What was
the body wasn't changed in 55 to any great extent. They put the new chassis underneath.
And the new motor.
Yeah.
What was the reason for the fiberglass? I heard varied stories about how that came about.
There was a lot of discussion on that, and of course a lot of people wanted to make it a metal, but it was felt that a fiberglass car could be made in low quantities. A lower cost than steel. And then it was also a new material with qualities that were desired for a car. Non-rusting. To make a car out of metal of that type would have cost many millions of dollars.
And so the startup cost in terms of body?
Startup cost was less with fiberglass.
Was it easy to mold? There were no
Well, there were people who had the facilities to do that.
So your job came with the early bodies out.
So Ed Cole or his people knew where to go to do that sort of thing. See, they had experience with, in their truck business, with bodies or parts of bodies made of fiberglass.
Oh, really?
So that led them into this field.
So the early 50s GM trucks used a lot of fiberglass.
No, the accessory people, I think, are the ones who did it. People who built things for Chevrolet.
I see. Who was Ed Cole made quite a splash at Chevrolet, obviously.
Corvette would be probably his first Triumph. He hit me in our era. Who was the guy, the genius behind the 55 Chevrolet design? Was that Earl and yourself and Ed working in tandem?
Yeah, I think it was all of us together. And we mustn't forget that both Earl and Cole were pretty hard taskmasters. They may not have known just what they wanted, but they sure knew what they didn't want.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as Earl was concerned, you found that out immediately. And with Cole, you could detect when he wasn't satisfied.
He didn't quite react very enthusiastically.
No, well, he'd say, well, did you ever try this or try that? You know, he wouldn't agree to it.
Yeah.
If he didn't think it was just the best thing since sliced bread, he didn't want to have any part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the people in our studio would just have gone to the ends of the earth to satisfy him, because he was such a fine person to work with, and he was friendly, and you know, everybody was his pal.
Uh-huh.
And they would do anything to make him happy. Now, Earl, you'd do anything to make him happy because you feared him.
He could still hire and fire.
Yeah.
Even though you were a studio chief, you were beholden to Arthur.
Absolutely. And you really had to watch it that you didn't get overtly too friendly to the division.
Really?
A little bit of that.
That would include, of course, include Ed Cole.
Yes.
He thought you were buddy-buddy with Ed.
Yeah, it wasn't too wise.
Working behind his back.
Yeah, and that's natural. I have nothing wrong with that.
I don't know if I've asked you this yet or not, but what were Earl and Cole's relationship? What was their personal relationship? Was it a bit stormy now and then?
Well,
based on mutual respect?
Well, they respected each other tremendously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Earl thought the world of Cole. He thought he was just a great person, probably the best engineer that he'd ever worked with. Because he never looked back. Cole never looked back. He was always looking forward. He's always looking for something new. There's something out there. He would come in and look through sketches and hope he'd see that one that set him on fire.
Uh-huh.
And eventually he would.
Uh-huh.
And Earl was somewhat the same way. I've known Earl to go through other studios, which are behind their locked doors, Pontiac, Cadillac, and find something, some sketch that he liked, and he would bring it in and put it in our room, or he would take something from our room and put it in another room. But this was a little trick that he had of inspiring, in his own way, other people.
He did not design, per se, himself.
No. No, I've seen him sit on in a chair and a dirty floor down here with clay on it, and he'd say, "Now, I'd like to do something like this." I'm doing this with my hands.
Yeah.
"Do something like this." And then he'd pick up a nail and he'd hold it like this. See?
Hold his fist.
Like that. Well, it wouldn't look like anything on the floor, but you gathered from what he said and what he was doing what the idea was.
His gestures and his tone of voice.
But as an actual designer, I've never seen him put a line on paper. But in the head, in the mind,
exactly.
He knew what he wanted.
And what he wanted and what he got was pretty much successful.
Mm-hmm.
There were a few plunkers in the
sure.
regime, but
sure.
for the most part, they were what the company wanted and what the public wanted. Did you have any input or do you have any observations on the Y job, how that came about?
That was a little bit before my time. Let's see, when did that come out?
1946.
Right after the war.
Yeah.
Maybe he was working on that during the war.
Could well have been, yeah. Looking toward the ultimate post-war car.
Yeah. He built the Y job, and then Charlie Chain, when he found out about it, and he was at that time at the tech center, and I guess he was in charge of all of the tech center. And he heard about it, and he said, "I want one of those too."
Uh-huh.
And somehow he maneuvered it to get his version. Well, he started with the Y job, and by this time, Harley Earl had lost some of his liking for Charlie, I guess. And maybe they were sort of in competition on it. But anyway,
Charlie Chain was the chief engineer at that time.
He had been chief engineer at Buick, but he became in charge of the entire tech center staff, I think.
Oh, that's right.
Anyway, he also built a similar car, but it didn't get the publicity that Elijah. And it wasn't nearly as nice looking. I think Harley probably gave him some rejected sketches.
But it was very innovative. And
oh, it was, yes.
Sort of laboratory on wheels.
Well, it had retractable headlights. It was very low. And it wasn't made for Harley, because Harley would sit in it and his head would stick up above the windshield. And he had to duck when he put the top up. But we'd often see Earl come in the morning, light sprinkle of rain, but the top would be down because he looked so silly driving like this.
He refused to put the top up.
Well, he had to cramp himself in to do it.
Yeah,
he was too tall. And apparently they didn't make the seat tall enough or something.
Did that cause something of a sensation within the design department, or was it accepted as a forward of the car that you all might have worked on? Were you doing concept cars occasionally?
Well, I don't remember concept cars back in those days.
How about the LeSabre from your old division? Was that done after you left?
No.
The first LeSabre.
Well, it wasn't done in conjunction with the Buick studio.
I see. It was done in a special studio. But it did have Buick.
In those things, Harley Earl was the chief designer and of the studio, as well as being vice president in charge of styling.
Right.
And it was done
his BS. So that embodied pretty much what he wanted in terms of. It didn't come out of the Buick shop.
No.
Just used the Buick nameplate for
the track. And that was a sensational car, too.
Yes, another laboratory on wheels. Any of that stuff translate into production cars that you can recall? Any salient feature that later showed up in the 50s?
Well, Sabre had its own fins.
Mm-hmm. The beginning of the fin there.
There were a lot of little aircraft things in the car.
Motifs.
Like the nose.
Yes.
The oval nose.
Right. The spinner.
It was really a radical car for its time.
Still exists. Mm-hmm. Both of them are still in existence.
Where are they?
They're at the Matthew Sloan Museum. GM has held on to their concept cars much better than Ford and others have done.
Well, I'm glad, but there are a lot of them that have gone by the wayside, too. Of course, we made so many of them back in the Motorama days.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that. What sort of requests would you get from Earl or other people to come up with something for the Motorama? Something annually you would have come up with?
First of all, he would generally throw it out to the divisional studios to do a car. What do you think is the right car? So we would, we'd conjure up a whole group of ideas and put them on paper, and then he and others would look at them and say, well, this is good or that's bad. And then he might throw in his ideas, or maybe he would in the beginning.
Yeah.
And we'd start a car of that type. And it was out of this kind of thing, for example, that we got to the Chevrolet Nomad station wagon.
Right. Did he use that as a case history of somebody coming out of the division that was a concept car?
Yeah, well, this particular one came right out of our division studio.
Right.
And we thought the year before this, we had taken a Chevrolet Corvette and made a fastback coupe and also made a hardtop coupe for the existing Corvette. As Motorama cars.
What year is that?
Well, that must have been 54.
Okay. The hardtop had just come into.
We didn't have a hardtop until this was done.
This was the first one.
Yeah, this was the first time. This is where it was created.
Mm-hmm.
And then from that, we just duplicated it almost for the production car.
Tell us about the Nomad. How did that come into? What was it like?
Well, we finally developed the idea of having a station wagon Corvette. Took a Corvette full-size drawing, raised the hood a little bit, lengthen the wheelbase and put a station wagon, four-passenger station wagon body on it. And Carl Renner, R-E-N-N-E-R, who we talked about before, was very influential in the design on that car. And he had done the roof for this Nomad with, first of all, Harley Earl wanted to have a stainless steel roof.
Oh, yes. Something new.
And so we did that, and then we put some little grooves that went around crossways over the top, which distinguished it from other cars. And, well, we did a number of sketches on the second pillar behind the windshield. We need it this way, and forward and backward and vertical, but we finally came up with the forward-leaning rear pillar.
Oh.
And put a line over that pillar and over the roof to distinguish the driver's compartment from the rear.
So a 285 angle, something like that?
Something like that.
Yeah, or 290.
And then we did the chrome-plated bars on the tailgate on the outside, like a luggage rack almost, but on the surface of the car. By getting the proportions, what turned out to be right, it became a very attractive car. And we showed that in the Motorama. And I think after the first night, I had been to the preview, came back, and I got a phone call from Howard O'Leary. He said, put that son of a bitch in production.
Really?
And so immediately, we went to the 1955 car, and we did all the same things on that. We didn't do the same things as the Corvette, but we put the new body on that was as close as we could possibly get it to the Corvette Nomad.
Uh-huh.
Now that Corvette Nomad model that we showed in New York never did get completed to the point where it was a running car. It was always a mock-up. We now have a Nomad Club. Are you aware of this?
No.
Well, it was formed shortly after the Nomad came out by some avid buyers, and it's been in existence ever since. I'm number one honorary member of it.
Oh, yeah.
It's located out in Colorado, and they have annual meetings somewhere in the country, monthly meetings all over the country. And I think that every Nomad that's been built is in their hands by now.
What was your particular contribution to that design, do you remember on that?
Well, as chief designer, you're a little bit involved in a lot of things.
Right, yeah.
And I really probably didn't do any one thing, depending on the individual designers to create the...
But you were the one who made the final decision at the studio level.
Yeah.
To release the final model. Mm-hmm. You call it an approval model. Would that have been full-size clay?
Are you talking about the Corvette or the prototype or the production?
Well, both, yeah. You were asked to do it as a special project, and as it came up, the first Corvette Nomad was a sensation internally and was selected for the Autorama, and then the public approval was so great that Earl wanted a production model.
Yeah.
On the Chevrolet, in the Chevrolet line.
Yeah, now it wasn't just Earl that wanted it. It was
everybody.
Cole and other.
Yeah, and O'Leary was actually their spokesman when he called.
Yeah.
So you mentioned briefly the sort of modification you made. What had happened to the 55? This was simply the station wagon, right?
Yes.
The regular 55 line had already been set.
That was already there, yes.
Had you had a station wagon in the line?
Oh, yes. Yes, we
did. That was scrapped?
No, it wasn't scrapped. It was continued. And the Nomad was added as an additional car.
Oh, I see, an additional model. It's like the high-priced station wagon.
High-priced station wagon. And that ran 55, 56, and 57. That was the end.
But
it was not a big seller.
It wasn't.
It's sort of a cult car now, I suppose.
Yes.
Or a collector's car. How many of them actually were made?
Oh, I don't know. But it was low production for
special
wagons because it didn't have the load capacity that a wagon would have. I think it was a forerunner of the times. I think today, if it were being built today, it would have been a different story.
I see. Would have been very popular with the current popularity.
Because
of
it was a luxury wagon. It had, you know, all the nice things in it. Carpeting throughout and so on. But in those days, a wagon was thought more of as a
small truck.
Small truck.
Yeah, right. You were the first one to come up with a stylish station wagon.
I guess so, yeah.
Yeah. An elegant appointed one. One in which you could take to the theater as well as the suburbs.
Now, the first, the regular station wagon the glass surface came back and then wrap around the windows to the tailgate. Nomad had the same thing, except it had fewer pillars to get in the way.
Right. Yeah. What was the name of the other station wagon? The Chevrolet that?
Well, I think it was just station wagon. They had Biscayne station wagons and
Bel Air station wagons.
Wagon.
Just these, yeah. The various series had each had station wagon. Yeah. The various appointments. Well, that must have been very satisfying.
Well, those were good days.
Yeah.
Those were good days.
Halcyon days. Everybody.
Because we all loved what we were doing.
And what you were doing, everyone else loved. Probably liked it. Or bosses liked it.
That's the icing on the cake.
Right. You could see it going down the street.
Yeah.
Well, the 55 and the 56 went very well.
Now, I might say that on the 56,
yes. The
people who wanted the wide front end on the 55 got what they wanted on the 56.
Okay. Which is the classic today? Which is the
I think 55, 56, and 57
are all classics.
Equally classic.
Yeah.
For different reasons.
Yeah. What were they?
Well, the 55 is simpler, cleaner.
Right.
The 57 is more ornate, it's the one that had the aluminum panel on the rear and the side, corrugated aluminum panel.
Oh yeah, that ran along with the
rear fender.
Rear fender. Oh yes, that was 57 was the first time they came in.
57.
Yeah, that was quite a decoration.
It was. Yeah.
Much sought after today than the 58.
I think maybe the 57 is a little more popular now than the 55.
Yeah. The you had a sort of a breakthrough in paint too in those days. Good paint. Metallic was coming in.
Yeah.
You were able to offer a lot of paint options that you hadn't had in the early 50s. The technology of the paint industry was a breakthrough.
Now, at that particular time, the division head had control of the exterior and the interior. It was later on that General Motors changed its policy. GM Styling changed its policy and had broke away the interiors into one complete extra group. But in my time at Chevrolet, the chief designer had control of both things, which was, from my point of view, was the best way to go.
Right.
You got control of the car then.
Right, rather than sections.
Yeah.
So in those days, you didn't have Chevrolet 1 and Chevrolet 2.
No, there was just Chevrolet.
One Chevrolet and one head designer.
We didn't have the multitude of cars that they now have. It was starting when I left in 62 to have more cars. For example, after Ford brought out the Falcon.
In 60,
was it?
61.
It must have been before that Chevrolet decided that they needed a competitor for that. And so in about 3 months, we designed a totally new car, which was the Chevy 2. It turned out to be the Chevy 2.
Yeah.
And got that out on the road because Cole didn't want to wait. He wanted to get this car out.
He was probably an ideal guy to have as head of the division. He was a
tremendous guy.
If he wanted something, he just bird dogging until he got it out.
Yeah. Well, he had his own way of bird dogging things.
Did he?
He insisted. He insisted and insisted and insisted.
In a nice way.
In his own nice way.
Yeah, and you knew that he wanted.
Very seldom saw him get angry at anybody. He might be upset, but he didn't seem to show up.
Now, in the interim, you're having great success in the mid-50s and later 50s with the Chevrolet. I guess you're only outsold once during that decade.
When was that?
I'm not sure. 1 year, I think.
Lost
by a few units.
Yeah.
But generally, what is happening to Earl at this point? He's sort of coming to his career is drawing perhaps roughly to a close. How did that come about?
Well, I think, and I'm just looking at it from the position I was in at the time, it seemed to me that there was some change in Harley Earl. And maybe he didn't know which way to go. But there was a period when we were doing the 58, 59 cars.
That would be 2 years earlier.
That he wanted to pour on all of this chrome treatment. He called it entertainment. He wanted entertainment on the side of the car.
Really?
And that was against any idea of cleanliness and design.
Yeah. And that you and others.
Something that a lot of us objected to. Sometimes internally and sometimes externally.
Yeah.
We didn't quite agree with that.
Were you able, at this point in his career, able to at least register your objection, or was it pretty much?
It had to be done carefully.
Carefully. Yeah. How did you work with that?
Well, sometimes you just had to, when he was there, do what he said to do, but then
subtly modify it.
Modify it later.
Yes. Hopefully he wouldn't notice it too much.
Yeah. But if you'll remember, there were, I remember the Oldsmobiles with lines along the side.
Yes.
And that's where I wanted to put the musical notes.
Okay. Maybe you're right. Yeah.
And huge big bumpers that were way down here. I remember one time.
About a foot high.
Yes. I remember one time after, I can't remember which Oldsmobile it was, after it came out, but it was one of those with the very low, big bumpers.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe Shemansky and I were wandering through the GM building, looking at the new cars, and we ran across Harley Earl. So he stopped and he said, "Well now, fellas, how do you like these cars?" And Joe must not have been thinking just right. And he said, "Well, I don't understand, Mr. Earl. Why are those bumpers way down there by your shoes?" And Earl looked at him and he said, "Joe, I ought to fire you."
But Joe had been there too long.
Yeah, well, he didn't really mean it, but it irritated him a little bit.
Yeah. Did he ever answer your question?
Why did you do it?
Yes.
No.
Yeah.
No, well, it wasn't worth answering. Because he felt that a big thing like that bumper down there made the car look lower.
Uh-huh.
And you'll notice in those days the decks dropped off. And it made the whole car look lower in their eye, in his eyes.
Yeah.
Not my eyes, but.
Yeah. But in general, you were slowing down, wasn't it?
I think so.
And you were noticing that the old fire.
He was. Yeah, some of that. And he was grasping for some of those ideas. I think he was not quite with it.
He hadn't grasped the new era of demand and the new thinking and style. He was still pretty much living in the past.
There was some of that.
He seemed to be more ornamentation, more chrome, more decorations, more gimmicks.
Yeah, and you look at the cars and they tell you the story.
Yeah.
The Buick.
Was there a movement afoot anywhere to say, "Look, Harley, this is not the way to go. We're moving ahead. You're standing still."
Who would say that?
Yeah, who would? Yeah, I don't know.
I didn't know anybody either.
Anybody at the executive level? Who was head of some person like Gordon, Jack Gordon said that.
Well, that might be, but Hardy Earl didn't treat his opinion that favorably, if it was different than his.
Right.
So
he was unrepentant to the end.
One of the big things that created a problem with us at Styling was when the Chrysler brought out the 57. The 57 had the huge big fins,
mm-hmm.
and the car was low.
The Exner.
The Exner car, yeah.
Yeah, right.
And that created a lot of problems with us. You know, everybody was running every way to get new designs that would compete with that.
To emulate it.
But there were bad things about the car that we couldn't have in ours. We had some of them. But in making it lower, you decreased the headroom, and they were getting pretty tight inside. And the seats were very low to the ground, so it was uncomfortable. Low to the floor, so it was uncomfortable to sit in. And I guess they weren't too good, well put together either.